It's like a Breath of the Wild is number 19 in the main series.
That's a lot.
Yeah, considering I've played four of them, two for NES, one for SNES, and then a Game Boy. So that.
Yeah, there were several on the mobile devices.
I mean, like the Game Boy game was like the first one. But yeah, I saw there were some DS ones. Whichever one I played for Game Boy, I can't even remember what it was. It was actually really good. It was like it played and looked like A Link to the Past for Super Nintendo, but they added some extra gameplay features. Like, I think you could like jump and stuff in it and play really
something
well.
With like the Windfish, as I remember.
It probably would have been either Link's Awakening or one of the Oracle games.
Link's Awakening was the one.
Well, welcome back to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. This is episode 74. That's right. I got that mixed up earlier this week when I was setting up the Facebook event for the recording. Labeled it as 75 and then realized, wait, I skipped a number. So 74 shall be the number of the counting, and the number of the counting shall be 74. We have a few people tonight, including a returning member and a new voice as well. But first, Gradia Dragon is with us tonight.
Yeah, good evening, everyone.
And we also have Boolean Dragon.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Hope you're doing well.
Linguistic Dragon has emerged from a work-imposed exile and has rejoined us as well.
I'm doing language science, and I'm still alive.
Well, that's impressive in and of its own. Self. So, and first time on the podcast, I believe, we are joined by Houston Dragon.
Hey, guys.
And actually, I got to give credit to Houston because he provided the link to the article that will form the bulk of tonight's topic. But just before we get to that, should, of course, give our usual and customary shout out to everyone who backs Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug and the Ultima Codex via Patreon. Thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the site, and especially a hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Dominic, Chris, Violation, Adam, Avatars Radio, Eric, Thorwan, Pascal, Neil, Helgriff, and Aaron. Do we have any new Ultima Dragons this week? Whoa, actually, my gosh, yes, do we have Ultima Dragons this week? And not just that. You know what? I actually need to go to udic.org and check to see who else is on the roster. Because you never know. Maybe there could be more than... But you know what? Even allowing for the somewhat incredible... join that we'll be discussing shortly. It is actually worth noting too that, and I mean, okay, granted, this actually represents a couple of weeks of, because we didn't record last week, even though I did have an episode ready to publish. But, so this does represent a couple of weeks worth of dragons, some of the names I'll be reading out. But there were a lot of dragons joining up. And... all right, so good to know. So, anyways, yes, new Ultima Dragons, and my gosh, there are a few. First off, on Facebook, we welcome Raven, Tiara, Clemens, Eddie, Diana, Doug, and this is actually Doug Rickett, the founder of the UDIC. Shelley,
about Stank. Time.
Yes, I know, right? We found him on Twitter. It took a while to get him onto the Facebook group. And I think you're right, Houston. And this is why it's important, you know, this is why if you're curious, you know, some of these asides that we bring up, good listener, if you pop into our Discord channel during a recording, you'll see that a lot actually happens in the chat channel. So for example, Houston is just, quipped. I'm pretty sure there were more than a few that joined from the UDIC 25th party. And that was the point I was building to, because this is quite a long list. And I did notice a bit of an uptick in the number of approvals that I had to dish out over the weekend that the 25th party was happening. Where was I? Right. Doug Rickett, Shelley, Stankus, Chris, Paolo, Steve, David, Victoria, Versacan, Dan, Michael, Jeremy, Paul, Thomas, a more different Michael, Iris, Byron, Maxime, and Jesse. We also welcome a handful of new Ultima Dragons on UDSC.org. In particular, we welcome Stack Dragon, Steve Lord Dragon, Narcissa Dragon, and Splut Dragon. And hopefully by now... Yes!
Heck yeah!
And hopefully by now you've all heard the news. Splut Dragon is none other than Richard Garriott. It's the name that he chose because, amazingly... Ah, well, okay. So our good registrars have done some... oh my gosh, our good registrars have actually done some very fun stuff here. So they have... they've got Richard Garriott on the list as... they do actually have him as Lord British Dragon on the list here, if you can believe that. But they also have him as Splut and as Cantabrigian Splut. Or is that Cantabrian Splut? But either way,
that's
yes,
awesome.
He's,
oh, I love that.
He's got a handful of names on the list here.
Well, he's got a little handful of names to begin with, so he it's does. Only appropriate.
He does, and he keeps accumulating them periodically.
He so. Does.
I guess that's a good habit to get into. All right. So anyways, yes, Richard Garriott is definitely now an Ultima Dragon, and this is an awesome thing. So what are we talking about tonight? Well, like I said... it was Houston that actually put me onto this article, and a lot of it has to do with, so this is at time.com, and the title of the article is Why the Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, so that's the newest Zelda game, 19th apparently published under the Zelda banner, reminds me of a 27-year-old game. It's by Matt Peckham. It was published on March 8th, so fairly recently. And, well, you know what, here's the opening couple of paragraphs of the article. I've been thinking about the way The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, one of the best things Nintendo's yet made, reminds me of another game that I played over a quarter century ago. Can't remember where, but at some point early in 1990, I read an interview with Richard Garriott, the same Richard Garriott de Caillou, now celebrated for catching a $30 million ride to the International Space Station in 2008. But in 1990, he was still better known as Lord British, after a benevolent monarch who ruled over a fantasy computer domain Garriott dreamed up in the early 1980s. The interview concerned the sixth game in that series, Ultima VI, The False Prophet, a swords and sorcery romp that also, unusually for a video game, wrestled with themes like racism and xenophobia. It's been 27 years since I've thought about gargoyles and codexes and vortex cubes, thus I can't say how a story that seemed weighty then might come across now. Spoiler alert, awesome. It will come across as awesome. Continuing quote, but I do remember Garriott explaining part of what inspired Ultima VI's world design stemmed from his frustration with the way puzzle solving in games worked. His anecdote is lost to me, but it involved a game in the classic adventure style where players have to pore over a scene and figure out what designers expect them to do. Let's make one up that's close enough. Imagine you had to get through a locked castle door, near which lay a rusted metal box and a sword half hidden in some bushes. Once you've noticed the sword, you can pick it up, then discover it can pry open the box, and presto, there's the key, problem solved. Try anything else, of course, and the problem is not solved, as in never ever. The box couldn't be kicked or dropped. The sword might as well have been a screwdriver or a crowbar. You couldn't knock on the door or just quit the scene altogether. These things were fixed points along a chain of deductions. You either saw them or you didn't. And if you didn't, since this was pre-Google, your only recourse was to dial the company's paid tips hotline. Garriott's punchline went something like this. Why wouldn't you just pick up the sword and hack down the door? Hence, Ultima VI, a proto-open world in which countless exhaustively cataloged objects from swords, treasure chests to cheese wheels and cutlery could be employed to interact in ways objects in games had never been able to. Each had its own weight and durability, a mind-blowing concept in 1990, a contrast with the relative spareness of the world in Square Enix's Final Fantasy, which graced North American shores by way of the Nintendo Internet of the Nintendo Entertainment System the same year. All right. So that's actually, I think, a pretty good primer to what Ultima 6 is. And I mean, it's something that we've kind of talked about before. Now, to be fair, Ultima 6 was not the first Ultima game to feature object interactivity, you know, in some sense, but I think it was certainly the first Ultima that, you know, kind of opened the floodgates of it. Ultima 5 had it to a degree, but not nearly to the same degree that you found in Ultima 6.
Ultima 5 had it. Ultima 6 took advantage of it.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it, right? Because, yeah, I mean, in U6, you know, like very, unless the chest was magically locked, you could just hit it with a sword, you know, break it open. And you could do that with a lot of doors too, or go get a powder keg.
Blow it up.
Yeah, exactly. Again, push unless it was magically locked. Sorry, what was that, Gridia?
Or you could push a cannon.
Ah, yes, the cannon. Excellent. So, now what does all this have to do with the latest Zelda game? Let's keep going. Yes, you could still patiently pick through the scenery for keys to doors and chests, but you could also throw caution to the wind and bash them to smithereens. The sense of something long anchored beginning to move was palpable. Giving objects heft also meant you had to think about how many things you could jam into a satchel, unless you realized the trick with the backpack and the bags. And the game included a rudimentary economy. You could buy wheat from a farmer, grind it at a village mill, bake it into bread. The birth of virtual toiling as unfettered bliss. Honestly, I actually can't remember being able to bake bread in Ultima 6. I don't know why everyone says you can, because I have no recollection of this whatsoever. I know it was a thing in Ultima 7, but I can never remember doing it in Ultima 6. Churning butter, yes. You could grab a bucket, milk a cow, go to the butter churn, and there you go. But I never remember the bread baking. Or have I been missing out for 27 years?
Clearly, experimentation must be done.
Uh-huh.
For yeah, science!
I know. I never did it. So, I don't know.
Once Lent is over, my daughter gave up video games for Lent, and in a spirit of solidarity, I joined her in this, forgetting momentarily that Mass Effect comes out, like, what, next week? But anyway. So, you know.
That is definite sacrifice.
All due sacrifice.
Major sacrifice points for you.
It's too bad I'm not trying to level up in that particular virtue. At least not this year. Actually, I honestly can't even decide what I'm talking about for the bite-sized virtue yet, so whatever. Let me go on. Now, how does all of this relate to Breath of the Wild? Well, the article kind of gets into it. Breath of the Wild couldn't be less like Ultima 6 when you contrast themes or tone or interfaces or visual design, and I'm not here to make tortured analogies between the two. Ultima 6 was a Western medieval fantasy pastiche you played from a top-down perspective. Breath of the Wild is like stepping into a watercolor dreamscape plucked from Japanese myth. These are decidedly different experiences. They're connection points at the highest levels, and yet, I think it's something to do with their shared reverence for player curiosity. But also maybe that Breath of the Wild seems, as Ultima 6 was, a glimpse of things to come. Ultima 6 attempted to imbue an entire world with an order of magnitude shift in mundane pliability. There was nothing else remotely like it. Breath of the Wild feels like another such shift. A masterfully Zeldified commentary on the delicate balance between wondering and doing. Now, I mean, okay, I guess some detail is worth it. And this might actually be a good time to share. So this was the funny video that I saw. and it involves Cuckoos, Hyrule's versions of chickens. And I mean, like these birds, as Houston Dragon was remarking upon just before we started recording, these birds have a reputation for, shall we say, doing great harm to Link. You know, they
don't mess with the chickens.
Yeah, don't mess with the chickens. But in this case, okay, because Breath of the Wild is very open world and a lot of its objects are manipulable. So in this case, a guy by the name of Video Game Donkey posted a video, I guess, probably to YouTube, that showed him. So he's got Link, and what Link has done is picked up a Cuckoo. And Link runs into a field with angry bokoblins. I don't know half of these pronunciations. But anyways, so Link runs into a field up against a big, angry, club-wielding Bokoblin, carrying the cuckoo above his head. And when the Bokoblin takes a swing with the club and knocks Link back, he also damages the cuckoo. And then gets swarmed and murdered by cuckoos.
That is just awesome.
So
death by chicken.
Yes, there was literally a death by
the
chicken.
The party I wanted to bring up that Lord British talked about dealing with open world and player creativity.
Yep.
You know, one of the things that he always put it in the game where Lord British was intended not to be killed. And of course, one of the favorite pastimes of Ultima players has always been to kill Lord British in some form or fashion.
Exactly.
And it was always through ways that they didn't anticipate. And so, you know, his going back to your point about, you know, picking up the sword that you had only one option to do. Many times they found that players would just come up with something completely random and it would work. And they were like, well, crap. And they would go to fix it the next time. And of course, players would come up with something else. To the point where, of course, by Ultima 7, they even started putting the in-game jokes of like the golden plaque hitting Lord British in the head and, you know, the Black Rock sword and things like that. But one of the things I did love with that article, why I did bring it up, was the fact that, again, the open world and the ability to do what the programmers did not intend, to come up with their own past and their own method of solving the puzzle, that, you know, changes everybody's game experience at that point.
Well, it does, right? And I mean, like, that's It's always dangerous to get into these conversations of what constitutes an Ultima, or, you know, what defines the Ultima experience, because I think part of the reason is that, you know, there's such a high degree of agency afforded to each player in an Ultima game that really exactly what defines the Ultima experience is going to vary, even if only slightly, from player to player, right? Because we all kind of approach the games just a little bit differently, you know? I'm sure there's people out there who just, you know, oh, well, I'm just going to play this game through to the end and then move on to the next one and be done with it. And then there's people like my sisters who will spend a year playing Ultima 7 with not more to show for it than thousands of loaves of bread baked.
And then there's Doug the Eagle, who goes and breaks the game entirely. So
yes. And the games are very, breakable. But of course, Doug doesn't just try to break the games. Yeah. Doug doesn't just try to break the games, though. You know, his rules are very specific. The game still has to be passable.
True. He's got to be able to complete the game in whatever fashion.
Exactly. It's often like the most wildly wrong fashion imaginable, but, you know,
there it is. Backwards.
Although I did like some of his methods of crashing Ultima 8, you know. My favorite is still, of course, you know, attack one of the civilian, well, get up on the edge of a pool of water, attack one of the civilians in town, and then dive into the water. So you die, but then Baron shows up to administer justice to you. But of course, you've already, you know, the avatar's already been deallocated by the heap manager. And so that particular pointer goes astray and brings the game to a crashing halt.
It is actually possible to get Baron to attack himself, and it's really funny and also crashes your game. So
yes, well, you know, I do remember that one too. So, but I think, and like, I mean, coming back to the chicken example, right? And again, like, this is specific to, you know, to just, you know, one example of rushing into combat and taking advantage of the fact that the chickens have been programmed, or the cuckoos have been programmed in such a way that, you know, if one of them takes damage, a whole swarm of them will show up to avenge the one that's been injured. But, you know, the game has been coded in such a way that the cuckoos, it's not just Link, you know? They don't care who hurt the initial one of them. That becomes their target, as illustrated by Video Game Donkey's experiment.
Chicken
here.
Justice is blind.
Exactly. Chicken Justice is very, very blind in Breath of the Wild.
And basically, we need a video of Ganondorf being hit by a chicken.
Oh, man, that would be a sight.
Would that be a little like Lord British being tricked into wounding a chicken?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
that was another fun thing to do in Ultima 6, was to clone Lord British and then charm the clone and then attack Lord British. Because then, of course, The clone Lord British steps in to intervene and That was one that I stole and did several times from Doug the Eagle. But of course, you have to make sure that you've barricaded the two into the throne room or somewhere together, and that the hostile Lord British can't get to you.
I need to see a YouTube video of that. Did he do like a whole YouTube series? Because I actually haven't. I heard briefly about that, but I don't know if he did it all on YouTube or what.
Well, it's mostly on his site, and he posted screenshots. But hang on, maybe I have that. I don't know. I might still have it.
It'd be cool if you could clone Lord British like 10 times.
So oh,
like
yeah, I do. It's actually my my woefully underused... Whoops. It's on my woefully underused profile. I'm going to just drop this into the Discord chat.
Football team. Lord British versus Lord British.
Exactly.
I want to see 10 Lord Britishes versus one Lord British.
Oh, that would be fun too. Now, of course, in my video, it didn't work out so well for me because, if I recall correctly, YOLO's a complete idiot. And
usually.
Like, basically, when you attack Lord British, he becomes hostile, and I kept combat mode on. So, of course, the party was kind of periodically... I cloned him. Gosh, I haven't watched this in forever. I think what happens is I clone him, and then, you know, I charm the clone, and then I attack Lord British. But of course, I've erected this barricade of solid objects. So I think I'm using YOLO as my attack dog here, right? Because he's got the crossbow, but he's kind of a klutz with the crossbow. And so he...
Again, par for the course.
Yeah. So he hit either a chest or a barrel one time too many and destroyed it, resulting in a breach in the barricade, which the irate Lord British quickly exploited to dispatch most of my party.
The walls have been breached.
Yeah. Run.
flee for your lives.
But again, like that was, I think, the charm of Ultima 6, right? And it's, you know, open world design was the fact that you could very frivolously just go into it. Just, you know, hey, look, here's a bunch of crates and chests and a cauldron and a milk urn laying about the castle. I'm going to cordon Lord British off in his throne room with these, and then I'm going to do experiments. I don't know why.
For science.
Yes, exactly. For science.
What's funny is that he wouldn't start attacking you as soon as you started building a wall of random crap in the middle of his throne room.
Just don't take his cutlery.
Well, I was going to bring up that story. He had never actually heard the story of the fork. And it was brought up at the party about how, you know, you're allowed to take everything in his castle, but if he's sitting at his, you know, at his table and he's eating and you touch his fork, then he, you know, proceeds to death bolt you to death. And of course, later in the party, one of the dragons ran up and stole his fork off his plate and ran. And
during dinner.
It was great.
Nice.
Glorious is what it was.
Outrageous.
There's a video of that, I think, and I didn't know what was happening. I saw it. Lord British started.
I was sitting at the table, and it was great because all of a sudden he turned. He's like, "What the?"
Yeah, yeah. I think he started.
Yeah, the guy was booking across the room. It was great.
Yeah. Lord British started screaming at him, and I was like, "What the hell just happened?" I thought he was going to refill his wine glass at first, and I was like, "What's happening?"
That is hilarious. I like to hear that. That's good.
Good service at Disney. That's just what happens.
That is awesome. You know, I keep repeating to myself, I will not buy a video game system just for one game. I will not buy a video game system just for one game. And yet.
I hear you.
I'm really tempted to just go rent a system or something because it really looks good.
Yeah, one of my coworkers brought in his Wii U to show off the game because we had some downtime today. And
my goodness.
Just kind of like, I need to have this in my life.
Exactly. It was everything I loved about Wind Waker refined.
Awesome. That is good to hear, actually, because Wind Waker was a pretty incredible game in and of itself.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting I noticed from my research and... You know, I haven't played a Zelda game since the first three, but like the lead designer isn't the lead designer of the original Zelda games.
No, they actually had to bring in a new design team Because the old guard just couldn't grok the open world concept.
And also the music isn't done by, was it Kenji Kondo, or I'm probably saying his name wrong. But anyway, yeah, Koji. Koji. Okay. And then the music's not done either. So it's kind of funny because, you know, we being Ultima fans, have a lot of respect for the old team. And now we're seeing at least parts of the old team, you know, trying to recreate essentially an Ultima using modern technology and Shroud of the Avatar, and with mixed results, you know, debatably. So people are talking about how Breath of the Wild, you know, is it just, you know, the best Zelda game ever made, or they're saying it's like one of the best games ever made. So the fact that it's missing like critical members, I don't know, that might be reflective of what's happening with Shroud of the Avatar. Is there a point perhaps where the old guard, you know, as you said, it's not that they just can't grok perhaps, you know, the concept of an open world, because I would argue that the very first game had an open world.
That's true too.
But
certainly the scale and the use of modern technology to convey the same kind of experience.
Right, exactly. So I wonder if that's something that might be more universal than simply the team behind The Legend of Zelda. You know, perhaps, you know, all these old guys, these gods of gaming, you know, that gave us all these classic series that we still love today. Maybe there's something to that, that it's extremely difficult for them to translate their skills and vision into modern technology and what's possible with it.
Can I cite two examples and a counterexample?
Of course.
All right. Example one, Ultima 7 Part 2 Serpentile. One hell of a good Ultima game. Pretty much no involvement from Lord British, apart from that he has the executive producer stamp on the, you know, in the credits. You know, largely developed by a side team, Sherry Grainer-Ray and Bill Armantrout and, you know, all of those guys and girls. Really, really amazing game. You know, probably the better use of the Ultima 7 engine, if I do say so myself. And probably, overall, the better RPG. A little more linear than Ultima 7, right? Not quite as sandboxy, but I think the better game overall. Second example, the recent Star Wars movie, Episode 7, you know, made by J.J. Abrams, entirely made without involvement, basically entirely made without involvement from George Lucas. Pretty darn good Star Wars movie, I gotta say. So there's two examples, I think, of where a team not particularly comprised of people who worked on the original in a particular property, nevertheless were able to craft a very worthy entry in the series, or in a series.
I was also going to bring up, going back to Nintendo a little bit, the old Metroid games that were originally 2D platformers.
Go on.
For the longest time, there was concern about making it into a new engine or making it into a new style. When they came out with the Metroid Prime games, at first it was a huge risk and everybody was sure it was going to fail. And they ended up translating it into a 3D, you know, open world platform where, again, very similar puzzles, very similar design. But of course, you're in a 3D environment. You're going up walls and going around corners and doing all sorts of cool things that made it a tremendous game. And again, it was not developed by the original team, but by a completely third-party company.
All right, fair enough. Now, the counterexample I was going to bring up was Ultima 8. Because here again, developed by, you know, essentially a team that didn't comprise too terribly many of the old guard within Origin Systems, and again, very minimal involvement from Richard Garriott, apart from, like, executive producer credit. And didn't exactly work out for the best.
Lost fail. just gotta say, man, come on, Lost fail. I mean,
without saying by this point.
Yeah, it would have been so much of a better game. I mean, even just looking at the design documents that, you know, again, GOG has up there now and people can review and read, it's just, there was no connection to the old Ultima games, and it unfortunately, it by itself, probably wouldn't have been a bad game. It just, there was so much that got left out and apparently ended up in a trash can somewhere that, you know, we'll never see the light of day, unfortunately.
Yeah,
hence
exactly.
The lost part.
Yeah, the lost fail.
Yes. So, I mean, I think it's one of those things where you certainly can, have the situation where the old guard or the original creators of a particular property at some point might need to step down from that property or need to, you know, kind of take a side role and let some newer talent come to the fore. But equally, I don't think that's a hard and fast recipe for success. I think that, you know, there is certainly both the potential for and examples of cases where that hasn't worked out to the benefit of the property in question. But in this case, it certainly seems that it has worked out quite handily. I gotta say too, my gosh, the world map for Breath of the Wild looks huge.
It is.
I have a link to an article that kind of offers a little bit of a sense of scale of it. And it's just like, oh my gosh, how huge is this game? Now, that can be for good or for ill, right? I mean, having a lot of space means you have to fill it with something. So hopefully the designers were able to, but it sounds like they were, because like some of the reviews I'm seeing for it are pretty tops.
From what I've seen of it so far, they definitely managed to fill it with interesting things.
Has anyone read any interviews with the heads of the design team to see like what their inspiration was, if it was actually previous titles or earlier titles? Like, because what the vibe I'm getting from this so far, without having played it yet, it seems a lot like the outside of the physics and stuff, obviously, but it seems a lot like the very first The Legend of Zelda for the NES, you know, with a sense of, you know, just open-endedness of not having your hand held, of a sense of wonder and exploration, you know, that same exhilarating feeling that we got when we played Ultima, of just being able to play in this, you know, massive, beautiful, and interesting environment without being bothered too much by the game itself.
Yeah, well,
I read a little about it. It's not much what I remember, but one thing that I do remember is that Aonuma mentioned that Miyamoto told him that he would no longer be involved in the Zelda production this time. He was leaving everything to Aonuma. He said, you have already learned all I can teach you. Now it's your turn to do it yourself.
So the student has become the master then.
Mm-hmm. So the way it works, by the way, in the game in terms of exploration is like basically from the get-go, they do take a bit of a different approach because you don't get waypoints. You have a tablet, which I guess is called the Sheikah slate, that kind of acts as a map, but the map is entirely blanked out to start, save for like boundaries between regions. And I guess this has become a thing in games lately. Assassin's Creed does it. Horizon Zero Dawn does it. But you basically have to locate and scale a series of towers to sort of clear away the fog on each new region of the map. But anyways, yeah, so you get the slate and you initially it's kind of just blanked out. But if you can see landmarks in the distance, you can mark those on the slate and then, you know, try and get to high ground and spot the shrines that you need to find and find a way to get to them. Excuse me. My goodness.
I've heard that there's a lot of side quests and a lot of things that you can do beyond just the main.
From what I hear, yeah. Like, despite the size of the map, it's evidently quite full of life. The corner spots are crafted in a way that they apparently feel very connected to the world overall. There's almost always points of interest along your path. And a lot of this actually, I guess, has to do with elevation. The game evidently plays a lot with elevation. So, you know, you're walking along the side of a canyon and then all of a sudden you see an oasis below. Well, geez, why wouldn't you want to go down and take a look? I'm quoting from the Engadget review at this point. But, you know, or you'll see something like on the horizon. I guess the draws distance is amazing. Or, you know, a shrine in some particularly obvious location. And again, anything you can see, you can mark as a landmark on your map. And then, you know, just kind of make a point of trying to get there. Which is kind of what you want.
It's the Legend of Skyrim, and you're the problem.
That is not the first time I have heard that comparison.
Yeah, although I think Far Cry came out before Skyrim, and it actually had an amazing draw distance. It similarly, you know, encouraged you to explore by what you can see on the horizon.
Yep. And I got to say, Above and Beyond, Skyrim Special Edition looks nice, but I got to say, Breath of the Wild looks a lot more colorful and prettier than Skyrim tends to.
Well, it is.
Good, good.
Now yeah. I really want to know if anybody's able to hook up a 3D headset to that thing, because as I understand, Skyrim and some other games are really, really great in a 3D VR style.
You know, I don't know. I haven't heard anything about Nintendo Switch supporting VR. I kind of suspect that it's not on the radar for the time being, but who knows?
Related things, I also heard a lot of hate towards the game. Most of it, I find it unfounded, just silly hating for the sake of hating. Like they say, haters gonna hate.
What? On the internet? In video games? Never.
Seriously, how can you hate on Zelda? It's like canonical. It's like one of the most iconic games.
Like this. Zelda's terrible. I hate it.
Well, yeah, okay, there you go.
Well, I mean, the same could be said for Ultima, you know, like how many people have gone on
Ultima 9.
Yeah, myself included, like Ultima 8 or Ultima 9, and, you know, some people love Ultima Online, and, you know, people despise it. So even with the best series, especially when it takes a departure from previously established conventions, it always happens. You know, I'm still stuck on, like, the first two Zeldas. You know, even though I played the Super Nintendo one, you know, I started seeing the 3D ones, and I was just like, you know, okay, this is a completely different game. It's like, I'm sure it's cool, but it's so different than the earlier ones.
And you know, like, everybody's looking for something different in a game too. I mean, what's appealing to one doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be appealing to everybody. And just because it's not appealing to some people doesn't mean it's going to be a terrible game.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still hung up on the fact that Metroid and Castlevania went 3D. So, because it depends on when you're born, I don't know.
Well, you know,
if you've ever heard the story of the guy that wrote the, you know, 4-page letters to Lord British about the how terrible the Ultima games were.
Oh yeah, the Glinky letters. I have. Yeah, some
and
of
then would
the
of course, he would of course pre-order the next Ultima the minute it was announced.
Well, yeah, and then write a 4-page letter denouncing it.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, there are some of the Glinky letters. Richard found a few of them and he shared them with the Codex, so they're on the gallery.
They're wonderful.
Yes.
And one of the complaints I've read is about the Nintendo Switch resolution, about the frames per second, and a lot of things which aren't... sounds much more like silly comments related to the console wars more than related to the game itself.
The only legit hardware crap I've heard has to do with the save system, where for whatever reason they did not intend for people to be able to back up their save games onto like USB drives or things like that. And maybe that'll change in a future release of the platform. But
that does seem, what's the word? Silly?
Well, especially because the Wii U and all the rest had that capability where you could at least back up your save so you didn't lose it if the console died.
Yeah, we were talking about it in a previous episode about how there were a lot of things about the Switch that were on the horizon that were planned, you know, but weren't out yet, that it was being released. Sans a ton of features, so they actually could patch something like that. It could be one of the many features that aren't yet present.
You mean developers rush things out and don't finish everything completely? No way.
That's crazy. I've never heard of that.
And at least they don't like ever lose the source code or anything, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, the gold
batch. The source code is always backed up. Right?
Supposedly?
Well, I mean,
they just copy it to a different directory on the same hard drive and say it's a backup.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, there's from my experience, there are lots of servers having backup. There's a For example, we have what's called the Blaze SDK, which is the code base for the multiplayer games. There are several versions of it. There's a version control system server where we have the base version, and each title, each game has its own branch with the with their server, their configuration files, all the source code, their specific components for each of those specific games. And, well, there's a lot of backup. Sometimes there's a failure on the server, but the server itself has several hard drives, and the server is just rebooted with a new hard drive, and the RAID array is rebuilt, and the server comes back up. It has lots of security measures. And also, some teams have their own version control server. So there's a lot of backup. And even if there are each developer has a copy on their workstation, the team which deploys the servers has a copy on the deploy server. The developers for the game client also have their version control system. They have the copies on their workstations. There's copies everywhere.
And then there's Amazon last week, who crashed half the internet by putting the wrong switches on their backups.
Yeah, actually, that's one thing that we try to avoid. Amazon Web Services are used for things that we won't miss. Things like load testing servers or things that don't hold unique data, things that can just be replicated with a template.
Well, that would make sense. And I mean, again, like, it's worth noting that you're like, here we're, what's the word? How do I want to phrase this? We're talking now about how, you know, yeah, like, it's much more common to have backups, and it's much more common to have, you know, redundant copies and everything like that. But, you know, like, so much.
Also, Origin has your save files on the cloud.
They do. But, you know, I think the joke that Linguistic was making there was that, like, I have the Ultima 7 source code, and I have the Ultima 9 source code. Where is the rest? You know, like, nobody seems to think that any copies exist of the rest.
Well, I'd also bring up, for example, with the Ultima Codex and even like Joe Garrity in the Origin Museum, like, there's a lot of game developers that disappeared in the, you know, 90s and early 2000s, that there's a lot of work that just is gone. It cannot never be recovered. And even there was a lot of discussion in older game communities that, you know, games that are not on GOG or games that are not archived well, you know, media decays after a while. Even CD-ROMs have a limited shelf life. And there will come a point where that data gets lost, and there will be no way to recover it. And that's a big concern for a lot of people.
It is. And I mean, like, I'm pretty scrupulous about making sure that I have, like, multiple backups of everything, like, cause I have a copy of, you know, the Mythic archives,
everything.
Yeah. Pretty much of the everything. Like, I have a copy of the Mythic archives, that the Wing Commander CIC prepared many years ago now, back when Mythic still existed.
When are you going to put Ultima Forever back up so we can play it?
Oh, I wish, you know.
Oh, don't we wish.
I wish I could. I just, it's still installed on this computer here.
Unfortunately, those had their version control systems on a different server.
I know. I'm just so mad they didn't patch it as a standalone. Such a waste.
I mean, I didn't have access to their version control system.
Yeah, the good news is we have most of the binaries. So while it would be nice to go through the source code and see, you know, exactly what was done at a higher level, at least we have most of the binaries for things, you know, one way or the other, whether or not the companies are defunct. Whether or not the means to acquire such binaries are legal, at least they're there. The most important thing is that they exist, that they are accessible, you know, for historical purposes. And the other good news is there is some other Ultima source code that is in someone's hands, and that I know about. And that's all I'll say about that.
Fair enough. And that's good. But, so, I mean, like, it's, but there's not a lot out there. You know, like there's...
And I'm not talking about a Colobus. Yeah, this is a much, much later code.
Fair enough. Well, and I mean, I guess technically it is easy to get at the code for like Colobeth and Ultima 1. Any of the Apple II Ultimas should be fairly easy to expose the source code for.
Yeah, list, except for the binary blobs or the machine code. Yeah, just list. There it
exactly.
is.
Exactly. But, you know, in the general case, it's, yeah. And it's a shame because like that's... Like, that does represent a loss. I mean, even if you had the source code, there's not that much you can do with it, right? Like, if EA ever wants to try and port Ultimate 9 to mobile, I have the code. They would be welcome to it, you know? Like, that would be about the only use case for it. Otherwise, I can just, you know, I can pop in the disk every now and again, and or in this case, hard drive, and flip through it. And actually flipping through the code is kind of funny, you know, sometimes because you just find the weirdest little things here and there, but you know, there's not much else I can do with it. Right. It's archived for posterity, but that's about it.
Yeah. But I mean, for educational purposes in the context of programming styles of the specific people that were working on it. It's almost like, you know, let's say you had you're reading Lord of the Rings, right? Now imagine if you had Lord of the Rings, that was twice as long, and the extra content was like notes, like Tolkien's notes, you know, and comments, like a comment in code explaining what something is, his own comments of, it would give you a deeper context. So yeah, it's like super, super nerdy. And for the common person,
actually,
it would be useless, but it to other people, it would be like, oh my God, you could see how they did it, what they were thinking, who they were, how they wrote it.
When you brought that up, his family actually released several of his notes and writings and things after his death that mm-hmm. when they went through
Christopher Tolkien did a lot.
Yeah, when they went through his estate, just, you know, scrap notes and scrap documents that he had put together, and they compiled it and released it for the fans.
Right, and if you were just a casual reader, you wouldn't give a damn. You wouldn't even want to read it. But if you're like a, you know, a Tolkien fanboy...
Unless you're Peter Jackson, then you'll make three boobs out of it.
But if you're desperate for more content, you know, and then you would absolutely love reading that. And the nerd equivalent or the programmer equivalent of that would be seeing the source code to these classic games.
That reminds me of Knights of Legion, which was left without any expansion disc. They were just left as a promise, as future development, but they never came out.
Crazy. You know,
so
your comment
you
about
left, you're left with incomplete training in several weapons. There are many weapons for which you don't have a place or a trainer to increase your skill on them.
Gotcha. Your comment about Peter Jackson in movies reminded me of there's a website called Eye of the Tiber, which is kind of it just satirizes. Well, it, like, I know the guy who does it is himself a fairly devout Catholic, and so it walks the line between between being satirical about Catholic news and using the Catholic news model to satirize world events. But he had this one article that just, for whatever reason, popped back into mind. Peter Jackson announces plans for 72-part movie series of The Silmarillion.
Oh, dear.
At a press conference today outside his estate in Beverly Hills, acclaimed director Peter Jackson announced his plans to make a 72-film adaptation of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Silmarillion. It was the next logical step after doing The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, Jackson said. In Lord of the Rings, we took over 1,000 pages of novel and adapted it to the big screen in 3 extremely long films. Then, in The Hobbit, we took a children's book a fraction of the length of The Lord of the Rings and also made it into 3 extremely long films. Jackson then unfolded his plan for Tolkien's The Silmarillion, which begins with a mythological account of the creation of Middle-earth and culminates in the great battles of the elves during the First Age. The first film in the series is set to come out in summer 2016, and then every 2 years, from 2018 to 2160, the following installment will be released.
You know, just keep in mind the 72 films is the theatrical release.
Yes.
And then the extended edition.
Yeah.
Returning to the original cinematic backgrounds of the Lord of the Rings movies, Jackson made an executive decision to save costs for shooting the outdoor scenes and had his studio purchase the entire island of New Zealand. In the long run, it'll cost us less.
That plus, actually wouldn't be a bad idea.
Plus, now the citizens of New Zealand, my sister included, are the property of our studio, so we get free labor to build sets.
Great.
Movie buffs and Tolkien nerds alike are ecstatic over the news, and Jackson, as usual, is enjoying the attention, teasing them about the contents of some of the 72 movies that they can look forward to. 16 of the movies will be almost exclusively footage of the elven folk doing various dances, and I don't want to say much, but the Silmarillion Part 49 is subtitled Gandalf Smokes His Pipe.
And I think that was the point the episode jumped the shark.
That pretty much sums up how I feel about the movies. I might be the only person who actually didn't like the movies. I don't know. And what's odd is despite their length, and I love long movies, despite their length, I felt like they left out everything that I needed to know what was going on and just had an infinite number of slow motion shots of completely irrelevant, non-plot advancing garbage. I'm like, really? You know, really?
Well, I mean, the more I watch them, the more I really start to see where a lot of the criticisms come in. What are some examples that I could think of just off the top of my head? Excuse me. Well, one in particular, like, you know, just at some point, and it's weird because it happens in both of them. Like, if you watch The Fellowship of the Ring, it's this very, it's much more faithful and even quasi-reverent towards Tolkien, towards the original material. But then as you start to get into the second movie, and especially, of course, the third movie, you kind of see where Jackson falls into the temptation of spectacle. You know, you kind of see where all of a sudden he's... the movies just seem to have progressively less heart and less warmth to them and substantially more effects and spectacle.
I would also bring up in the third one the complete change from the theatrical to the extended edition of how Saruman gets handled.
Yes, that is also kind of a problem.
It just changes the entire story for people who, you know, watch the different movies. So
yeah, exactly. And then he does it again in The Hobbit.
There are several points which are completely different. Like Sauron doesn't appear at all. It's just shown as a huge eye in the top of a tower, when in the books he actually appears and confronts Aragorn.
Yes. Like, I mean, stylistically how they presented Sauron worked, but just, I don't know, like the first movie has such heart for it, and it's like it feels like there's a real reverence for the material, you know, like for Tolkien and the material that comes from Tolkien. And then as you start to work your way through the second movie, it starts to kind of get away from that. And I mean, by the time you're at Helm's Deep, it's basically just pure spectacle. And then likewise, the third movie. And I really wish that he had put the Grey Havens in the third movie. I really wish. Yes. I can live without the Scouring of the Shire, but I really wish he'd put the Grey Havens.
Well, all the films would be 30 minutes shorter if they stopped using slow motion. Seriously, it's funny, but it's actually true.
Well, there's that. But then it happens again in the... It happens again in the Hobbit movies. Because, like, the first Hobbit movie is... Actually, I think the first Hobbit movie is wonderful.
I liked it.
It's...
The first Hobbit movie actually ended on a really great moment.
It did.
That could have been two films if they had just put everything else into the second film and not padded. They padded so much stuff into there that, again, for the appendices, for the people that Kevin said were like longtime fans, sure, that'd be great to go back to. But it just felt like he was just churning for the sake of churning to put the time in it. And it just, to me, was flat.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. And just this whole... And again, like, I mean, a lot of it just comes down to, yeah, like you say, churning and spectacle, right? Like, I mean, the Battle of the Five Armies is, what, over in 2 pages at most in The Hobbit?
Yeah, and it's not about the actual battle. It was about settling peace. Instead, we got the, you know, huge CGI war, which was pretty, but kind of pointless.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the first movie was, you know, again, much closer, much more intimate. They had the songs, like, oh my gosh, so yeah. Well done. And then it just kind of fell off.
Yeah, I think, like, remember the huge combat scene in Braveheart? There was, yep. Like, so many people, and it was so violent, and it was just awe-inspiring when you saw it. It was because we hadn't really seen anything at that scale before, and people have been sort of chasing that ever since. But you get used to it after a while, and the fact that they're still trying to do this when we've already seen it 1,000 times, it does not have the same impact that it used to, and it's a bit of a waste of time.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Actually, I found the Hobbit movie quite inspiring, and not so much for the second and third part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely say the spectacle is fine and has an importance if it's part of the story. I just don't like it when it's simply to just
spectacle for spectacle's sake.
Yeah, just if you want to show off your cool CGI, that's great, but that's not really what interests me that much.
Pretty much. Well, fortunately, it sounds like the Zelda game isn't just 3D for the sake of being 3D. So there is that.
I was wondering when we were going to bring it back around.
If I could,
good call with Stan. If I could, I'd like to read just a very short snippet from Wikipedia here on the gameplay.
Go on.
Right. And this is right up my alley as far as gameplay is concerned. Like what we were talking about with Ultima, you know, hacking down a door instead of trying to find the damn key wherever it is, right? Just yeah. The obvious, you know, multiple solutions to a problem through the implementation of systems. Here we go. Players control Link, of course, who can jump and climb almost any surface and can find various items in the world, including weapons, shields, clothing, and food that can be eaten to restore health. Weapons break after excessive use, but many have multiple uses. For example, tree branches can be used to light fires, and shields can be used as makeshift snowboards.
Nice.
Blah, blah, blah. You can create bombs controlling magnetic objects.
Chickens can evidently be used as makeshift weapons.
Right. And stopping is truly emergent gameplay. And stopping time around objects and enemies. So it almost reminds me of, Half-Life 2. They started to get into that sort of, organic, non-linear solutions to problems based on physics systems. So that's a radical departure from Zelda. I mean, that's getting into more like Grand Theft Auto, type systems.
Yeah, what it comes down to is it's more of an exploration game than previous entries in the series have tended to be. And when it comes to exploration-focused games like Breath of the Wind and, you know, the Ultima games, the most memorable moments are the moments where a player pauses for a moment and goes, wait a minute, I can actually do that? And it's hard to account for because there's no way to consider everything that a player is going to do, but if there's enough moments like that in the game, then it's going to be something special. And honestly, I think I've been thinking about this practically all day, but I think that's a good portion of the reason why I'm enjoying Tides of Numenera so much, because it's not necessarily an exploration game in terms of an open world and, you know, all the various things you can do, but it is very focused on exploring a single a character, what you can do as a character. And how do I put this? Well, one of the earliest quests you have is you walk into the, you know, main town of the beginning of the game. And in the very front was essentially a public execution. And you talk with one of the characters, one of the NPCs, you know, in the crowd who's observing the execution, and he basically gives you the quest to save the guy. And, most standard RPGs would have a very direct, focused way of getting to do that and maybe have some big decision toward the end of it of how things are going to fall out. But Tides of Numenera, You can go the direct route and try and rescue him using brute force. You can try to incite the crowd around him to act and intervene on his behalf. You can try to pose as a city official by going through a somewhat roundabout way of either stealing or bribing other officials to get you the proper credentials, to bluff your way. There's so many different ways you can go about it, and so many different ways you can actually get background information on the situation, because you get the sense that the guy who gives you the quest in the first place isn't telling you everything. There's a couple different ways you can try and get more out of him. You can try and talk to the victim himself. It's just all these different things that come together that maybe go, wait a minute, I can actually do that this time around.
Nice.
Yeah, it flies in the face of every convention that's been established by, you know, every successful game since Ultima 7, basically, is what it sounds like.
You can do anything.
Well, it's maybe not quite do anything, but it's enough to make you feel like you can try.
Sure, and that was the illusion that since Ultima 5, to a degree, and really 6 and 7 created, it giving you the sense that you can do everything while allowing you to do a lot. You know, that counts for a lot. You don't see that too much outside of Grand Theft Auto these days. A few other sandboxy games.
It reminds me of when I was playing. I was game mastering. It was a Dungeons and Dragons campaign, and everyone was new to tabletop role playing, and they kept asking, "Can I do this? Is it possible to do this?" And my answer was always, "You can try."
Yeah. Well, that's really what it comes down to, right?
True. So. And there's a lot of things where you cannot even try.
Yep. No, that's very true. Because, I mean, that's much the same as I think the appeal of, you know, an Ultima 6. And I think that's probably what the appeal of Breath of the Wild really is that you can just try, you know? Maybe something will work. Maybe it won't. You don't really know, but you can try.
Players have been conditioned to not try. And if 90% of the games that you play that show you a hyper-realistic door on a hyper-realistic building, and when you first do it, you're like, okay, cool, a door, let's open it. Oh, it doesn't do anything. And when that happens so many times, you start to realize, oh yeah, buildings on the left, buildings on the right. It looks like a door. It's not a door. You realize you go straight, you kill the enemies, and that's that. So when you run into a game where all the doors actually open and there's actually something inside, you know, it does. It's kind of like the elephant with a chain on his leg all his life, and you take the chain away and he doesn't move because he thinks the chain's still there. You know, it's like the gaming version of that.
There's something funny. We were talking about it at my job today or earlier today. It's about the passwords. We were talking about the requisites for password. They require between, usually they ask you to make them between 8 and 16 characters in length. You have to use alphanumerical characters, symbols, and numbers. Well, it's alphabetic characters, symbols, and numbers. You have to use that, and you're limited. So you get to come up with a password using that, and then you easily forget it. And because of the small length it has, it's very easy to crack. It takes about 3 days at most. If you make 1,000 tries per second. On the other hand, if you didn't have the limitation on the length, you could just use 4 common words with no punctuation, with no numbers, nothing. Just a simple phrase made up out of 4 words. The length makes it so complicated for a computer that it would take about 500 years to crack with 1,000 tries per second. And you wouldn't just forget it. it's very easy for humans to remember. On the other side, the other password, the shorter one with symbols and everything, it's very easy to forget. So what was being talked about was it has taken us 20 years to train people to come up with passwords they forget very easily, and computers can crack very easily.
Yeah, I still think they should require that you use the Alt key and the numeric keypad to enter a bunch of non-displayable, non-visible ASCII characters for your password.
Well, I you're talking about that XKCD comic. There's actually a great website. If you go to, what's it called now? CorrectHorseBatteryStaple.com. No, .net. CorrectHorseBatteryStaple.net. And it's entirely presupposed on, you know, it basically works around that theme. It'll basically create you a password of three or four words or more if you want, that, you know, work on that principle of, you know, a longer password that's still easier for you to remember. Now, granted, for all of you listening, never use correct horse battery staple as your password. Okay, because every password cracking software I've messed with over the last couple of years now has that baked into its like default password list. But the principle itself is sound. Yeah, I actually have that cartoon taped permanently to my desk at work. And for good reason, because it is very true. Oh, y'all got quiet all of a sudden.
Long Citizen Valuable Chairman 7.
Everybody's nice and curious. You don't want to jump in.
So, all right. Well,
we need to bring up the most important thing.
Go on.
Who's going to Canada to get Tibby to make the next Ultimate game now that he's done with Andromeda?
Well, you know what? If he's ever in town again.
Just say.
I was going to say, I think Withstand the Fury is the closest.
Well, I don't know. Some of you might be closer to Quebec than I am.
Oh, good point. I know I'm not.
Yeah, I'm in Georgia, so yeah, it's a bit of a drive.
Mm. Yeah, same here. Two people from Georgia in the same podcast. What are the odds? All we need now is David Beard Commander.
No, I'm just saying, he, you know, considering the fact that he works for BioWare and considering the fact that he just helped launch their next big title for him, again, they wouldn't have to beg EA to license it. They already are part of the same group.
Well, the problem is, you know, EA dipped their toe in the water or in the acid or lava with Ultima Forever. So the idea, and I know to us, of course, that's silly, you know, Ultima Forever, not really a real Ultima. They tried whatever, but okay, the execs at EA, all they need to know is, hey, we tried Ultima. It failed. We're not going to try it again for another 20 plus years, right?
I'll be honest. I think part of the reason they did that too is because of copyright law, where you have to develop or do something with the property to maintain it.
Oh, wow. I have not heard that theory, but that's a good one.
But again, and this was discussed at the party, and this has been discussed multiple times with Richard Garriott and his books and everything else, but he really ticked off EA in a serious way to where they just don't really ever want to deal with him again. And I think it would just behoove that if anybody has access and ability, you know, again, Ian Fraser works for BioWare, is their lead developer for the new Mass Effect game, and certainly would be the one I would think that could actually bring it to the light, being a dragon.
And that sort of goes back to what we were talking about before, as far as passing the torch. You know,
Tibby looks like Richard Garriott. If you set him side by side, he looks like a mini clone. It's really funny.
It sounds like him, but you know, he's young. He knows what he's doing. He has an established track record, you know, of success, at least as far as we're concerned. And I think soon enough we'll see that, you know, with his effort with Mass Effect. So it makes sense. They don't have to deal with Richard Garriott, you know, outside of licensing Lord British, which I don't think is necessary to make a new Ultima game. The game's not centered around Lord British, so it could actually happen. I just don't know that the execs will touch the property because of Ultima Forever.
Hard to say. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I'd very much like them to. I'd very much like Tibby to be at the forefront of it, but
I think what made the Ultima games great to some extent was Richard Garriott's curiosity and experimentation.
You may be right.
Well, he had a tabula rasa. He had a blank slate when he started making Akalabeth, when he made Ultima, the first one. What else was there to compare it to other than pen and paper Dungeons and Dragons, you know, and Tolkien's works? So certainly, you know, he could have gone in any direction he wanted to, and he certainly did. You can't really do that now. Well, that's certainly skill.
Going back to the premise of this podcast when it first started is, you know, they're basically going back and reusing systems that are 25, 30 years old now in games because the technology is there. Like, they've got the graphics. They've got all the other fancy, flashy stuff. Now they can actually do the open worlds and the stories and things that go with it. And, I mean, I applaud BioWare for, like, again, Mass Effect, Dragon Age, Knights of the Old Republic. I mean, there's some tremendous story writers that do work in their company. Plus, you've got the greats like, you know, the Warren Spectors and the rest that are out there that are, you know, writing and making really, really good games. So I do believe that, again, the creativity is one thing that Richard definitely had, but the overall team made the series itself really great, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways that's very true. I was going to say, this is a total topic shift, but Kevin, to your point about, like, you know, not, you know, having really gotten past Zelda 1 and 2, so, you know, let alone being able to accept a 3D one, it might interest you to know that the prototype for Breath of the Wild was an 8-bit game.
How is that possible? Do elaborate. Wow, okay.
Hang on, do I have Discord up on this machine? Probably not. Oh, I do. Huh, look at that. Multiple logins. Well, here, let me just drop that into chat, and you can go and check out the video. It's a video of a presentation of the, I guess, a prototype. So this was shown off at GDC, I guess, what, last week?
Yeah, that was in California,
I think. Yeah, yeah. So San Francisco. Slashy was there, that's right. So, but anyways, yeah, they showed this off. And I mean, basically they used 8-bit graphics, reminiscent of like the original Legend of Zelda. I guess the underlying engine was 3D, but.
So this was like a skin, a 2D skin on a 3D game then.
Exactly. And they kind of used it as a template. But you know what? I think there were a lot of comparisons, and there have been a lot of comparisons between Breath of the Wild and like some of the original Zelda games. And I wonder if maybe this didn't help frame that for them, you know?
Well, it'll isolate the underlying gameplay without being distracted by 3D assets and all the fireworks of current gen graphics.
Yeah, so like I say, I wonder if maybe this didn't help them with that somehow, you know?
It's pretty cool. And for the listeners, if you're not familiar, Hardcore Gamer is an excellent website.
Yeah, they're pretty cool. They cover a lot of good stuff. All right. Well, let me see. Do I have anything else? What's this about?
Yeah, no news today.
Oh, actually, no. This one I liked. And I posted this on Facebook, I think. But the Nintendo Switch cartridges evidently taste horrible.
Yes, it's so kids don't eat them accidentally.
Yes. And as a parent of small children, I can totally appreciate that.
It's like, a lot of people didn't just get it. That surprised me at a group of gamers on Facebook. They found it stupid and a lot of things. And even when someone say that's to prevent people from bringing into their mouth, and said, who would be stupid enough to bring to their mouth? And they just didn't get it. So there's a lot of, I guess, they just don't get it unless they are very smart or if they already have kids.
I think that goes back to your haters gonna hate type of thing. I mean, again, Zelda was like my generation. I'm 40 years old. I mean, that's the game I grew up playing. So, I mean, most people in my age group are loving the fact that they're going back to these properties and these franchises to continue the game. So, yeah, totally makes sense that you don't want your kid choking to death on a game cartridge.
Well, yeah.
How big are these cartridges?
They're not much
like
bigger
an
than
an SD card.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so like, and also there's prior work similar to that on the Wii U. The discs for the game discs for the Wii U have rounded edges. So if your kid brings the disc into their mouth, he won't cut his mouth with the edges.
Which is nice too.
Safety first.
Yeah. And like I say, I mean, I read this headline and I'm just like, as a parent of a small child, I totally get this and I love it.
Any information on what they actually taste like and what chemical they added to the plastic to flavor them?
Yeah, there is. There's the name of the
a bittering agent, denatonium benzoate, has also been applied to the game card. This bittering agent is non-toxic.
You know, this will be the current modern version of soap in a kid's mouth now.
Yeah, you talk like that again, you're going to go have to eat that Mario cartridge.
You're going to get a Switch cartridge.
Oh, boy. But I mean, it is such a good idea.
They'll make an E.T. game, and that'll be its only function.
And here's the article I'm pasting to the chat. The article for the Wii U discs.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. Oh my gosh, yes. What else? I did have a couple of other little things here. Siberia 3, which I think I mentioned before, I guess is out and apparently is quite good. That will probably be of interest to my friend Miles and only a handful of other people that listen to this. But if you like adventure games, that might be one to check out. And I know we mentioned the ZeniMax settlement. So I suppose it's worth commenting on the inevitable follow-up to the ZeniMax settlement. Which is that John Carmack is now suing ZeniMax for about $22.5 million, which he claims they owe him still from when they purchased id Software in 2009.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I'm disappointed. I thought you were going to say that Notch won the Scrolls trademark issue.
No, I don't think that has happened yet, unfortunately.
Quake 3 Arena. Very sad.
I was actually having a discussion with Dr. Cat there in California, and he was talking about id and like Ion Storm and all these other game companies that just went crazy with basically spending money on things that didn't really need to be spent money on versus developing the actual games. The 90s were apparently a very crazy time for game development.
Yes, from what I gather, yes. It's kind of a...
So Carmack is claiming like that he owns intellectual property that he wasn't properly compensated for when he left the company, that they're continuing to exploit or something?
He claims that ZeniMax has refused to pay him the final installment they owe, nor are they allowing him to convert it into shares. Carmack, at the time of the purchase of id, had received a convertible promissory note valued at more than $45.1 million, half of which he converted into ZeniMax shares. And so he is asking the court to compel ZeniMax to pay him the outstanding sum from the sale.
Well, it sounds like he'll win. Seems pretty clear cut.
You'd think. But this is the American legal system, after all. Who knows?
Yeah.
Depends on what quick claims and how the sales were done and everything else. But interesting to see.
Yeah, there you go. So that is all I had.
No Castlevania news? No,
no, I haven't. But you know what I forgot to ask? Good idea. How's your week been? A couple of weeks, actually.
It's been training work and also been working my game. Rewriting the beginning and giving names to the gods, rearranging the pantheon, adding, moving around stuff. Mostly work in my game.
Well, that's not bad. And if people were looking to find you online, where could they go?
You can find me on Facebook, Shengdong Gradilla, or here on Discord.
Brilliant. Who's next on my list? Houston, what you been up to these last couple of weeks?
Well, I got back from California in the 25th anniversary party, which was a heck of a lot of fun.
Nice.
Other than that, working and planning for the Festival of the Silver Sharpen in May.
Oh, tell me a little bit more about that, because I have honestly forgotten many of the details.
Well, there's two big events coming up. There's the festival in May, and then, of course, there's Hobloth, which will be in November in Austin.
Right.
The festival is more of a smaller affair. Joseph Drazen is the Unseen Dragon.
Oh, right. That's his thing.
And, yeah, he actually hosts it there at his home. And basically, it's a lot of crafting. His neighbor is a blacksmith, as I understand. so there's a lot of virtue-based quests and things that take place, and just a lot of camaraderie. Unfortunately, I missed it last year because of a death in my family, but definitely wanted to go this year.
Awesome. So that is happening again this year. I'm going to have to put something up.
Yeah, it's the weekend of the 5th, I believe, is when it's taking place. Registration may be closed, but if you can certainly donate or check it out.
Yeah, totally. Cool. And if folks were looking to find you online, if you're even comfortable with saying anything to that effect, where could they go?
Well, I'm usually always on Facebook and or the UDIC Facebook group. And I'm there under John Hosey, a.k.a. Houston Dragon. So,
awesome. Awesome. Boolean. How's your week been?
Yeah, good. I just got to say, I think that's the first time I've ever heard the words death in the family followed by awesome. But
well, okay. It was a sad event, but at the same time, it was not to jump back into his time. But I got to actually reconnect with a lot of my family, and
so it was awesome.
It was a good event for me. Like I said, it sucked missing things I wanted. It was actually my birthday weekend of all things. But you know, it was nice. I got to see my dad. I got to see a lot of my family members, and we did get to remember. It was my grandmother who had passed away. We got to remember her life and. You know, it was a good experience for everybody.
Well, that's good.
Cool.
So sometimes you just got to accept it.
Yeah, and I do, believe me. But I have a dark view on life, so I embrace it. But I've been just, again, working on the playroom, ripped down the LED rope, filled in all the holes that made by the screws and such in preparation for painting the walls white. And this is actually pretty cool. I'm like ultra excited about this. I have a laser printer, I have transparencies, and I have an overhead projector that I got from Craigslist. And I'm actually going to download the pixel art from iconic NES characters in, you know, all their full glory poses, such as Samus Aran and Link from the original Legend of Zelda, and, you know, the Vic Viper, and all these good pixel art, you know, icons from the NES, and edit those in the GIMP. Print them out so they're friendly to being displayed on a transparency, project those onto the wall, and then take a piece of foam, square-shaped foam, which I'll basically use as a paintbrush, and I'm actually going to paint pixel art portraits on a black background on the white wall in the playroom. So you will see actual accurate pixel art painted on the walls of the playroom. So I'm super, super excited about that. So
that's
prepping
awesome.
Yeah, I'm prepping it for that. I can't wait. Of course, I'll take photos and put them on Facebook. So that's about it, other than the usual. Of course, you can find me, Kevin Fishburne, 8 Virtues, Voskort Betmani, and 8V, the number 8V radio on Facebook for my classic chiptune internet radio station.
Your Gargo Shack scent still needs work.
Yeah, I know, right? And what's even worse is lately I've been pronouncing Voss as Vass. I did it twice. Tonight and a few podcasts back. So just slap me through the wires. Yeah.
Well, if it comes to that. It needs to be more guttural. More guttural.
It does, actually.
More gargish. I need to get the going on.
Exactly. You need to sound like you are not actually a demon, but still look rather like you might be an eldritch horror of some kind.
A very civilized apex predator.
Exactly. With large wings and teeth. And you, Linguistic, how have you been?
I have been pretty good. I have been in recovery from the 25th the past couple weeks. I was sick the entire time I was there, but I didn't for a moment let it stand in my way. But I was definitely feeling
You're
it when
one
I got
that
back.
The concrete.
Yes, it was probably me.
Oh my gosh. So good time though.
It was a very good time, and it has the memories of it have been pushing me to finally get thoughts together for Savage Empire posts that have been forthcoming for way too long. Covered a couple things in my Gargish lesson at the 25th that I haven't actually put up on Ultimate Journeys yet. So there may be a sequel to my previous Gargish dissection at some Ooh. Point.
Well, that's all right.
I had a feeling that that might be the general reaction.
Yeah, that would be just fine. All right. And of course, you can find me, WTF Dragon. I am on Twitter. I am on Facebook. I have various other social media profiles that you can find through my about.me profile. And of course, I'm at ultimacodex.com.
Wait, you are?
Am I? I don't know. Crap. Where am I? Oh, right. I'm in my basement. Oh, yeah. I'm supposed to find my smoke detector down here. Then you got to remember to do that tonight. Anyways. On that odd note, thank you all for tuning in for another episode, and until next time, be virtuous.